AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Those weren't happy little accidents Robbie Moss was fixing on live TV. They were calculated casualties in a psychological war.
And that quote, I mean, that's taken directly from what's alleged to be an after-action review. It just cuts right to the bone of what we're looking at today.
It really does, because today we are doing a deep dive into something that, on the surface, just sounds like a crazy urban myth. But the more you dig, the weirder it gets. We are talking about the case of Robbie Moss and his public access painting show, The Canvas of Calm.
Yeah, and we're not just telling a spooky story here. The whole point of this dive is to unpack how something so benign, a painting show, could be subverted. We're going to walk through the timeline of this alleged 3-year psychological weapons program.
And we have the files, or at least excerpts from them. Redacted reports, timeline anchors. Our mission is to understand the mechanics of it. How did this guy with a friendly afro and a soft voice turn his art supplies into, well, operational tools?
We have to look at the specifics, the chemical engineering of the paint, the biological elements, the coded signals. And of course, that final bizarre act, we're really going deep into the bizarre, the terrifying, and the chemically volatile here.
So let's start where it all began for the viewers.
Yeah.
At 3 a.m.
The witching hour.
Before anyone in intelligence was calling this a weapon, it was just a comfort.
Yeah.
A little light in the middle of the night for thousands of people who couldn't sleep.
Exactly. You have to picture the time. Right. Early 1980s, cable TV is still kind of raw. You're flipping through channels late at night, and it's mostly static. And then you land on this.
And there he is, Robbie Moss. He's got this signature afro, this incredibly soft, almost hypnotic voice.
Mm-hmm.
He just looked like the picture of harmless creativity.
He did. And his whole thing was teaching people, insomniacs mostly, how to paint these simple landscapes. You know, happy little trees, fluffy little clouds. He was accessible.
He made it seem like anyone could do it. Like you could just pick up a brush and all your stress would just melt onto the canvas.
And that persona, that gentle therapeutic image, was the key. According to the analysis files we're looking at, that was his operational genius. He called it therapeutic camouflage.
Okay, let's stop on that, the timing. The show ran for about 3 years, always at 3 a.m. on public access channels, which are all decentralized.
Not prime time, and that was deliberate.
Why, though? I mean, why not aim for a bigger audience?
Because they weren't looking for a big audience. They were looking for the right audience. Think about the demographic at that hour.
Insomniacs. People working the night shift.
People who are neurologically exhausted. The sources we have suggest these targets were in a state of heightened suggestibility. It's that state right between being awake and asleep. Hypnagogia. Your cognitive defenses are just down.
Your critical filters are off. You're not there to analyze what he's doing. You're there because you want to turn your brain off.
Precisely. You're looking for comfort, for repetition. It's the perfect low scrutiny environment. If you want to run a covert broadcast operation, you don't do it on Monday Night Football. You do it where no one is really paying close attention.
And public access at 3 a.m. is about as low scrutiny as it gets.
It's perfect. The documents say this was all calculated. He was building this rhythm of calm and trust. He needed his audience to trust him completely before he even started with the active phase of the operation.
So the whole gentle vibe was engineered to bypass their critical thinking.
Yeah, to let the more subtle, maybe frequency-based parts of the show sink in without anyone consciously noticing or rejecting them. He wasn't just building an audience. He was building a community of, for lack of a better term, compliant subjects.
Which brings us to that phrase he was so famous for, happy little accidents.
Mm.
To everyone watching, he just looked like he made a small mistake, you know, smudge or a drip, and he'd just cheerfully paint over it and turn it into a bush or something.
But the source material just flips that on its head. The analysts who reviewed the tapes years later, they had a very different take.
They weren't accidents at all, were they?
Not even close. They were calculated cues. A little deviation in his technique, a slightly different color mix. They served as timing markers, signals for the next phase of whatever he was doing in that segment.
So when he said happy little accident, it was like a go code.
In a sense, yeah. And this is the core finding, the thing that changes everything. Intelligence agencies later confirmed the show was not harmless. It was a sustained, sophisticated psychological operation. That's when the focus shifts from art to intent, military intent.
So every single brushstroke, every quiet little phrase, it all had a dual purpose. Oh,
the landscape on the canvas was just the background. It was a beautiful, calming decoy for a really sophisticated delivery mechanism.
And the delivery systems were just his everyday tools, his paints, his brushes.
Exactly. So let's get into that. We have to understand the material science here because this is where it starts to get really strange.
Okay, so the chemistry, his paint, that's the first major sign that something is very, very wrong here. The files say he wasn't just mixing colors, he was painting triggers.
And we need to zero in on one color in particular, titanium white. It's one of the most common colors for any landscape painter, right? For clouds, for highlights, for mixing.
Of course.
Well, his titanium white was not standard. The documents, even the redacted parts, describe it as a psychoactive paste, highly engineered.
A psychoactive paste? What does that even mean?
It means it was stable at room temperature. He could handle it, put it on his palette, no problem. But it was designed to become volatile under a specific kind of energy.
And that energy was what?
The heat from the studio lights, the big, powerful lights you need to film a TV show.
Oh, wow.
As soon as that paste hit a certain temperature under those lights, it was engineered to release hallucinogenic spores into the air.
So just by turning on the lights to film the show, he was turning the entire studio into a hot zone, a chemical weapon delivery system.
A closed system environment, yes. The whole set became an active agent dispersal area.
The level of technical resource for a public access show is, it's just staggering. I mean, the budget for something like that must have been.
The files describe the budget as disproportionate by a factor of hundreds compared to a normal public access show. Think about the chemical engineering required to do that, to stabilize a hallucinogen into a paste that you can paint with and then have it release on a thermal trigger. It's incredibly sophisticated.
And there's proof that the air in that studio was toxic, right?
Yeah. There's a supporting detail that is just undeniable.
Hazmat suits.
The hazmat suits, the camera crew, the people literally filming this supposedly relaxing art show, they allegedly had to wear full body hazmat suits just to get through a taping.
That is the smoking gun right there. Yeah. You don't wear hazmat suits to film a guy painting clouds unless something is deeply, deeply wrong.
It's the link. It confirms the environment was physically dangerous to anyone in the room except presumably Robbie Moss himself. He must have had some kind of immunity or maybe was taking a counteragent.
So the Kree knew. They had to know they were dealing with something hazardous, even if they didn't know the full story. They were told to put on these suits and just film.
Which is chilling in itself. But then you have to think, if the crew needed that level of protection from breathing the air in the room, what was happening to the viewers at home?
They're staring at the screen for 30 minutes, sleep-deprived, highly suggestible, breathing in the digital ghost of this chemical cloud.
The show's atmosphere wasn't just calming, it was literally chemically toxic. And that wasn't even the strangest thing on the set.
Okay, let's talk about Peapod,
the
pocket squirrel. He kept this tiny little creature in his shirt pocket, and he talked to it. It was presented as this charming little mascot.
But the files describe Peapod in very different, very clinical terms. It wasn't an animal, it wasn't a squirrel.
What was it?
The term they use is a parasitic biological homunculus.
I'm sorry, a what? A homunculus? Like from old alchemy texts.
Exactly. The concept of a miniature, fully formed human. But here, the context implies something else. A lab-grown, non-natural, biological entity. Something engineered for a specific purpose within this operation.
And that purpose was tied to the paint.
Directly. The files say Peapod had a very specific diet. It fed on the alizarin crimson paint.
The deep red color.
Yeah. Moss would deliberately let it drip down his fingers into his pocket, and this thing would consume it.
So the crimson paint wasn't for the sunset on the canvas. It was food or fuel.
It seems to have been part of a chemical loop. You have the white paint releasing spores. Those spores are interacting with the environment, with Moss himself. Then he introduces this other pigment, alizarin crimson, which is historically a heavy metallic pigment. Peapod's function might have been to act as a biofeedback monitor.
So it was cleaning the system.
Yeah.
Or stabilizing him.
That's the hypothesis. Monitoring his exposure levels, maybe processing the toxic byproducts from the spore reaction. It wasn't a pet. It was a required piece of biological equipment. A safety device or a control mechanism.
So we have a guy on public access TV releasing psychoactive spores into a studio where the crew is in hazmat suits while a lab-grown creature in his pocket eats his paint.
It completely shatters the illusion of the gentle painter. He's not just a man painting. He's an operator running a live, toxic, biologically monitored chemical weapons test. And Peapod is the constant living proof of that.
The sheer audacity is what gets me. And all of this, the chemicals, the biology, it was all just the setup for the actual transmission.
Right, for the segment.
The brush cleaning segment. Even for people who just thought it was a quirky show, this was a part that always felt off.
It was a total break in character. He'd be calm, methodical, almost whispering for 20 minutes, and then he'd stop and say, "Now we have to beat the devil out of it."
But he didn't just tap the brush on the easel like other painters do.
No. The witnesses and the later audio analysis describe something much more violent. He would violently thrash the easel, just this chaotic, explosive burst of energy.
And while he was doing that, the calm voice was gone.
Completely gone. While he was thrashing the canvas, the files say he was simultaneously screaming coded coordinates into his microphone.
Screaming them so people could hear it.
No, that's the genius of it. The coordinates were hidden. They were digitized and masked inside his laughter, a really raspy, guttural, high-pitched laugh. It was a form of acoustic masking.
Okay, explain that. Yeah. How do you hide data inside a laugh?
Well, you use a loud, chaotic noise, the thrashing, the screaming laugh, to carry a structured, quieter signal. To a human ear, it just sounds like a guy losing it for a second. Manic laughter. But a machine, or a properly conditioned human subconscious, could pick up the structured frequency patterns hidden underneath all that noise.
So he was broadcasting data packets under the cover of a supposed mental breakdown.
That's exactly it. The broadcast shifted in that moment from psychological manipulation to active, high-frequency data transmission.
And this is when the broadcast engineer started noticing things. Strange audio spikes.
Right. They weren't just hearing static. They were seeing structured anomalies in the audio frequencies. And the effects on the viewers at home, they were immediate and physical.
The nosebleeds.
The nosebleeds. People in states hundreds of miles away from the studio would call their local stations, complaining of sudden, severe nosebleeds that started at the exact moment he began the brush cleaning segment.
How is that even possible? How can an audio signal from a TV show cause a physical reaction like that from so far away?
The analysis in the files points to a couple of possibilities. One is infrasound. Very low frequencies that we can't hear, but our bodies can feel. It can cause resonance in our internal organs, pressure spikes. The other theory is a very specific high frequency, the one hidden in the laughter, designed to cause mechanical resonance in the tiny bones and fluids of the inner ear.
Which is connected to your sinuses, your nasal passages.
Exactly. A sudden pressure change in the inner ear could easily trigger a nosebleed. The signal wasn't just going to their TVs, it was interacting directly with their biology.
That's terrifying. But it gets even stranger.
The reports
from the Midwest. The cornfield blackouts, this is maybe the most disturbing part of the whole operation.
Yeah, these reports center around Ohio, mostly. And they all have the same elements. Total amnesia and displacement. People would report going to sleep watching the canvas of calm, and then
waking up in the middle of a cornfield.
In the middle of a cornfield. Often cold, disoriented, still in their pajamas. And here's the detail that ties it all together. They were clutching blank canvases.
A blank canvas. And they had no memory of how they got there.
None. No memory of leaving their house, walking, or driving. Nothing. Just a block of missing time.
It sounds like the aftermath of an abduction. Or a covert mission.
And that's exactly how the analysts interpreted it. You have the spores creating a state of deep suggestibility. You have the coded audio transmission triggering a specific action sequence. And then you have a built-in memory wipe.
They were using the viewers as unwilling agents.
As temporary unconscious assets. That's the terminology they used.
But for what? What were they being sent to do in the middle of an Ohio cornfield?
The files are redacted on the specific missions, but the speculation is they were used for tasks that needed a quiet, local human presence. Maybe dropping off a package, picking something up, maybe just acting as a relay point or mapping coordinates.
And the blank canvas. What was that for?
That's the big question. It could be a symbolic receipt, proof that the triggered action was completed. Or perhaps they did paint something, or something was placed on the canvas and then it was taken from them before they woke up, leaving it blank. Either way, it confirms that Moss wasn't just influencing his viewers, he was deploying them.
Turning his audience into a sleeper cell they didn't even know they were a part of?
A disposable amnestic field team, which all leads us to the grand finale, the end of the 3-year run.
The final broadcast. 1984. This is where the line between psychological warfare and something else completely vanishes.
The whole show, he starts painting something simple. It looks like a door, like a small wooden door on a cabin or a shed in one of his landscapes.
Pretty standard stuff for him.
At first. But the files are very clear that as he kept painting, something impossible started to happen on the canvas. It stopped looking like paint.
What do you
mean? I mean, it started to look real, three-dimensional. It wasn't an optical illusion. The crew who were there in their hazmat suits, they said it began to look like a tangible physical object that was literally sticking out of the canvas.
He was painting something into existence.
The technical analysis in the files is wild. It speculates that the combination of the psychoactive paste, the specific audio frequencies from his final Beat the Devil Out of It segment, that they acted as stabilizers for a temporary, an interdimensional aperture, a doorway. The paint wasn't pigment anymore. It contained compounds capable of anchoring a localized rift in space. The entire 3-year show, all the tests, the cornfield agents, it was all R&D for this, for creating a reliable exit strategy.
Fake exit.
The exit. He finished the painting, he looked at the camera, gave this calm little smile, set his brush down.
And he walked up to the canvas?
Walked right up to it, reached out, turned the painted knob, which was now a real solid knob, and he just stepped through, disappeared into his own painting.
Gone. A perfect, untraceable exfiltration.
And the response from the agencies proves they knew this was coming. They were watching.
How quickly did they get there?
33 minutes. 33 minutes after he vanished on a live broadcast, a federal SWAT team raided the station. Not local cops, a specialized tactical team.
That fast. They must have been staged nearby. They were expecting it. So what did they find when they got in there?
The studio was empty. No moss, no peapod, and the door on the canvas was just a painting again. The aperture had closed.
But there was physical evidence left behind.
Oh, yes. The brush he used for the final painting was still on the table, still wet, and it was loaded with this silver liquid. Definitely not paint. This liquid was so potent, so corrosive, it had already started to eat through the brush and was burning through the wooden floorboards of the studio.
So it was some kind of catalyst.
Yeah.
The fuel for the portal.
A final stabilizer, maybe? Something incredibly high energy. The forensic signature of an impossible event. It proved that whatever happened, it was physical. It was real.
And there was one last thing.
One last thing. Scrawled on the back wall of the studio in bright phthalo blue. A message.
There are no mistakes here, only happy little nightmares.
Yeah.
Happy little nightmares. It's the perfect awful bookend to his whole happy little accidents persona. It's a confession, a mission summary.
It's a confirmation of everything, the calculated intent, the psychological damage, the cold-blooded nature of the entire operation. It's him signing his work.
So to try and wrap my head around all this, we have a painter who is actually a highly trained operative.
He used a TV show as a cover to run a 3-year psyop. He weaponized his paint to deliver hallucinogenic spores. He used a parasitic lab-grown creature to manage the chemical blowback.
He broadcast coded data hidden inside screams and laughter, causing physical harm to viewers hundreds of miles away.
Used those viewers as amnesiac field agents. And then the whole thing culminates in him literally painting a dimensional door and using it to escape, leaving behind a corrosive, unidentifiable substance.
It is, hands down, the most bizarre operational file I think we've ever looked at.
It's a textbook case of subverting benign media for a terrifyingly complex agenda.
It really makes you think. If you were up late one night watching that show and you felt strange, maybe it wasn't just that you were tired. Maybe you were part of the mission.
And that really brings up a final provocative thought for everyone listening. You know, something to chew on. If a low-budget, public-access painting show could be weaponized this completely with advanced chemistry, bioassets, frequency manipulation, what other seemingly harmless media that you consume every day might be carrying its own hidden payload?
What's hiding in plain sight on your screen right now? That is a deeply unsettling thought.
Hmm.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the absolute madness of the canvas of calm. I, for one, will never look at a landscape painting the same way again. If you want to see the full breakdown, the timeline, more on the forensic reports about that silver liquid, you can find all the source material we pulled from over at Inspector Story. Until the next deep dive, stay vigilant. And maybe stick to books after midnight.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.